You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. This spring marks 20 years since the fall of apartheid and the first democratic elections in South Africa. Although the country has made progress over the past two decades, conflicts and inequalities remain. Sociologist Catherine Newman looks closely at the persisting friction within society by following seven South African citizens in her new book, After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa, written with Ariane Delanoy. It's published by Beacon Press, and it brings Catherine Newman to us today on The Leonard Lopate Show. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So the upcoming elections in South Africa are the first that people born after the end of apartheid will vote in. Has the post-apartheid generation been active in politics or in the campaigns?
The post-apartheid generation has actually been voting for a while, but it's the first one since Mandela's death. And that, of course, is a momentous occasion. In the initial period after the fall of apartheid, their parents were extremely active voters. Their voter turnout was vastly higher than anything we've ever seen in the United States. But since that time, there's been a steady decline in voter participation, and particularly skepticism in this generation as they look at their leadership and ask whether or not they could even come up to the knees of the great leader they've just lost.
The head of the Institute for Security Studies said, quote, "This will be the last election in which the majority will be voting with their heart rather than their head." What do you think she means by this?
I think she means
Do you agree?
No, I don't really agree. But I think what she means is that the legacy of the struggle, which is so defining of legitimacy, even in political terms, is particularly vivid in the minds of those who are in the older generation of voters right now. And they bank a lot of their confidence or lack thereof in their political leaders on what their role was in tearing apartheid down. That is starting to come to a close because that generation is shuffling off. And what is taking its place is a generation raised in a democracy, a flawed democracy, as many democracies are, who no longer accept the struggle as the sole guideline to whether or not someone should be given political office.
And is that the key marker that has this election different from previous elections, do you think?
I don't think this election yet is completely different because Jacob Zuma is a leader in part because he rests on his credentials from the struggle. But the skepticism that voters feel about him, particularly because of charges of corruption and even criminal complaints, have led to a collapse of confidence in the ANC. Mm-hmm. The trouble is that there isn't a lot to replace it. There isn't another party that can even come close to the kind of political strength that the ANC has. So there's a real problem in South Africa with not having a replacement that or alternative that people could mm-hmm. turn to.
But Catherine, isn't there also conflict between the ANC and President Zuma?
Oh, yes. There's conflict everywhere, internally, between the parties. It's a messy situation, as true democracies often are. So Zuma's policies are less the question than his personal character. Mm-hmm. And those of your listeners who watched Mandela's funeral know that Zuma was booed in the course of that funeral, which is quite a dramatic statement of how people feel about him.
And talk more about how people feel about him. If you could give an example or two of why Zuma was booed, which, as you alluded to, is an extraordinary thing to happen when the entire world was watching.
I think we have to understand the context. South Africa is now the wealthiest but the most unequal country in Africa. So you have people who have done very well, especially in the post-apartheid period, like Jacob Zuma, and are perceived as having used their office for personal gain. So Zuma built this tremendous compound with public money, millions of rand that were used to build his private home. And a lot of his cronies are seen as having sort of lived off the resources of the state. Well, millions of black Africans are suffering from poverty below the UNDP line and are living in dangerous townships. So I think he was booed because people no longer think he holds that kind of moral compass that the early leaders of the ANC had.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Catherine Newman about her new book, After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa, and it's published by Beacon Press. So given this discord and upset there in South Africa and with the elections coming, what kind of changes do people want to see in their country?
The first thing they want to see is that the promises made to them are fulfilled, and that is a very tall mountain for anyone to climb. When you think about the condition of the country when Mandela took over, you had millions of people with no housing. You had thousands and thousands of children who'd never been enrolled in school, widespread illiteracy. And even today, you have massive public health problems, tuberculosis, HIV. It's a country of great prosperity, magnificent beauty, incredible potential, and millions of people suffering who want those promises fulfilled. And that is a tough, tough road to climb.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the post-apartheid generation, how different are they from the generation before it? Leave aside the fact that they're living in a democratic society as opposed to what came before.
I think they're very different because the experience of apartheid is now a memory, not an active part of their lives. They can go where they want. They can seek a fortune. They can go to school. But now everything depends on whether or not they come from families of means, because skin color isn't the only divide anymore, which was true of their parents. And so their class background, how much education they've gotten, really defines what their prospects are in the labor market. And that is a huge difference between them and previous generations. It also creates a kind of politics of personal responsibility, if you will. They tend not to think, oh, I'm where I am because of these structures that were put in my way. Mm-hmm. They think instead, well, if it's really possible for everyone to get where they want to go, how come I'm not where I should be? How come I'm still poor?
Talk a little bit more about the differences between whites, blacks, so-called coloreds in South Africa in this post-South Africa period, post-apartheid South Africa period.
So black Africans have been the beneficiary of a series of legislative acts that were put in place to redress the huge barriers they'd faced before. They benefit from forms of affirmative action that are rigorously enforced and that have made a difference, that have created a new black middle class that simply wasn't there before. The reverse has been the case for whites. They would have been guaranteed a good life in the past. Now they have to scramble, and there are millions who are not doing very well. And they're seeing that as a form of downward mobility and deprivation. They look at the ANC and say, well, they campaigned for a colorblind country, but that's not what they've put in place. They've put in place a country that's defining people's options by their color. So they are very disillusioned often. What is really important, though, about this young generation is they are committed to the country. They do believe in its future. They're dismayed by their political leadership, but they're not looking to jump ship as their elders were. They want to see the country work. There are more relationships across those colored lines, and they are struggling to find, particularly the whites, are struggling to find any kind of legitimate place, given that their ancestors were the sources of all this oppression.
So this new generation, how do they view the events of apartheid and the history of oppression in South Africa?
Well, they're still very angry about it because people in their living memory, their own parents, suffered from it. And they know that their own positions in the world have been affected by that history. But they also understand that it's the past. It's a past with a long shadow. But it's the past, and now they have to find a way forward, and they're looking for that path, which is why they're so disappointed in their political leadership. They've got to get over that hurdle so that they will have leaders that will help them define that future. But they're very differently positioned depending on whether they've been successful or not.
Mm-hmm. Do they want to remember and learn from that past, or do they want to forget about it and move on?
I don't think anyone wants to forget about it. I'm leaving for South Africa tonight to celebrate with them Freedom Day. Freedom Day commemorates the election of Nelson Mandela 20 years ago. Where in the United States do we have a holiday celebrating an election? No, they remember and they believe in that struggle and what it represented. It's the future they're worried about. But no, I don't think anybody's ready to forget the past yet.
And I was going to ask, how difficult has it been, is it to move on? 20 years isn't much time to come to terms with all that went on, all that happened under apartheid.
Well, look, here we are, how many years past the American Civil War, and we still have very deep sources of racial inequality. So I think 20 years is a short time. But Ariane and I decided to write this book because we felt it would be a time when this assessment or self-assessment would be something of importance in the country and here.
Talk a little bit more about that connection between the American Civil War and that of apartheid. What connections do you see between the aftermath of the American Civil War and apartheid?
I think when you look at the Jim Crow laws that followed the end of Reconstruction in the American South, you see a system that was very, very familiar to anyone from South Africa. Race laws, segregation, extraordinary oppression, unequal support of public institutions, terrible schools for black children, privileged schools for white children. Really, when I first got to South Africa, it felt very familiar to me from the history of the Jim Crow South. And that's why I thought this assessment was important, because other scholars before me had tried to understand what had changed since the Civil War when they went to study the Jim Crow South. But we have very parallel histories, and not just with respect to race, but also with respect to immigration. And that's something people don't realize is an issue in South Africa as well.
Talk about that. What are the immigration issues in South Africa?
Well, it is the most prosperous country in Africa, and it is bordered to the north by failed states that are letting streams of refugees, some of them just trying to escape horrendous violence, mm-hmm. and others looking for an economic opportunity, much as the Mexican population comes across the border in the south of the U.S. So we have a very similar situation. The difference is that in South Africa, those refugees are coming from countries that sheltered the leadership of the ANC during the struggle. But when they arrive in South Africa, which is mired in heavy, heavy unemployment, they are treated as pariahs. And there are horrible incidents of violence directed at black refugees coming from other parts of Africa.
And are these people, because you said just a second ago, these are countries that where ANC folks went during apartheid. Are these people, are these South Africans, former ANC folks, coming home to South Africa, or are these Botswanan and Zambian folks coming in?
They are refugees from Zimbabwe, refugees coming all the way from the Rwandan civil wars, walking across the entire length of Africa with their children on their backs to reach a country that, for all of its flaws, is thought of as a beacon of the rule of law, as a place of freedom and democracy. And they are giving everything to leave their countries of origin and come to South Africa for a better future.
Before we go to break, I have to bring us back to the American connection, because I wonder, did the civil rights movement here in the United States affect how apartheid was seen and how it was dealt with, you think?
Yes, I think that it's the reason why there was an undying connection between progressives who were involved in the civil rights movement and what became an important part of the anti-apartheid struggle, which were the sanctions placed on South Africa, the economic sanctions. So there's a very close parallel there, and one that many people of my generation found as an inspiration for our interest in South Africa.
I'm speaking with sociologist Catherine S. Newman about the inequality that remains in South Africa 20 years after the fall of apartheid and the country's first free elections. She's the co-author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in South Africa. It's published by Beacon Press, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, speaking with sociologist Catherine S. Newman about her new book about the inequality that remains in South Africa 20 years after the fall of apartheid. It's called After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in South Africa. Catherine, you talked to a lot of people in your for your book, and you met a lot of people doing this book, and you described the difference between the city area of Cape Town and Paarl and the outskirts, such as Khayelitsha. Can you talk about these areas and how they're different?
Yes. Khayelitsha is a shackland of about 500,000 people, about 15 minutes' drive from one of the most beautiful cities in southern Africa, Cape Town. The people who live in Khayelitsha live in structures that would best be described as iron shacks. Mm-hmm. They have on top of them plastic roofs that are weighed down by old tires. They're living in a sand pit. There's no greenery there. It is bereft for the most part, of any greenery, stores, parks. It's really a slumland, and it is burgeoning because millions of people are moving from the undeveloped parts of South Africa to the West, where there are more jobs, and they end up in these communities because it's the only place they can go. In the city center of Cape Town, it looks like San Francisco. Hmm. It's a beautiful harbor city with stunning colonial-era buildings and a blue, blue sky with a stunning Table Mountain behind it. The contrast between a place like Khayelitsha and the center of Cape Town couldn't be stronger. People in Khayelitsha may as well be on another planet. They live in a place where there's no indoor plumbing, where it's dangerous to go out at night if you use a latrine, where I've been told many times, don't wear any jewelry, don't drive a car that doesn't look battered up because you could be robbed in a moment. It's a pretty desperate place in many ways, and that's where I found some of the people I've spent the most time with.
What the listeners couldn't see, you were showing me a picture that's in your book of Khayelitsha, and if anyone has seen the movie Constant Gardener, which was filmed in Nairobi and in the slum Kibera, you can then visualize what Khayelitsha looks like. So let's talk about the people you met. Let's start with Amanda. What's her story?
So Amanda was born in Port Elizabeth, which is a city further to the east of Cape Town. And she actually comes from a family that did relatively well over the years. Her grandfather was a truck driver, which was a good job to have and a hard one to get if you were Black African. Her grandmother raised her, as is a very common pattern in South Africa. Her mother is not doing particularly well, but she barely knows her mother, really. It's her grandmother that she knows best. She was in that first generation of Black South Africans who were able to access white schools. As apartheid began to crack open, a few of what they called Model C schools began to admit a small number of Africans. And because Amanda's grandmother worked as a cook in that school, she got her granddaughter in. This has been a huge benefit to Amanda. She speaks four languages. She is very comfortable in multiracial situations. She today works in an NGO in Cape Town that addresses public health crises in South Africa. So she has a white-collar job. She's very polished. She's not economically secure in the way that someone who would be even wealthier might be. But relative to the people living in Khayelitsha, they are worlds apart. So Amanda is what we would call struggling middle class here. But there is no way anyone in her family ever would have been able to be that upwardly mobile had they not been able to get the education that Amanda accessed, which was available to a tiny, tiny number of Black Africans.
So her story is unusual.
Her story is the story of this growing Black middle class. It's unusual in the general scope of things, but there are many more people like Amanda than there ever were under apartheid. But her counterparts, which are far more numerous, are those millions of people stuck in places like Khayelitsha who are desperately poor.
So you also write about Thandiswa. How is her story different from Amanda?
So Thandiswa does live in Khayelitsha. She actually lives in one of the better parts of Khayelitsha, but she has been unemployed almost all of her adult life. I would say that she suffers from bouts of clinical depression because of this persistent unemployment. She's the mother of two children out of wedlock. She lives in a household of 10 people, only one of whom has a real job, and that is a pretty struggling job as it is. So Thandiswa, when she can find work, and in the time I've known her, she might have worked for a total of maybe 8 months, she feels much better. She has tremendous drive when she can see any kind of opportunity, but most of the time she's depressed because she doesn't see her life going anywhere.
But Thandiswa believes she has total freedom to do and be whatever she wants to, yet there are all these barriers in her way. Why is it so hard for her to see this?
She has legal freedom, but she doesn't have mobility. She could go anywhere legally, but she can't get anywhere because it lives miles away from Cape Town, and there's nothing but a rickety bus system to get her there. And her education isn't going to equip her to do what Amanda has done, which is to find a white-collar job. Unemployment in South Africa veers between 25 and 50%, and in Khayelitsha, it's well above 50%. So we're talking about a country in which the inequalities are so pronounced that the people at the bottom are struggling to survive, while the people at the top, who are now Black and white, have much more opportunity.
So drugs and alcohol were a big problem for Ambrose. Another person you profiled in the book. Was addiction a common problem during apartheid?
Addiction was a problem during apartheid, but the drug problem has gotten worse because under apartheid, there were tremendous restrictions on physical movement of people of color. They had to have a pass equivalent to a passport because they were defined as not living in their own country. And that tended to keep the drug trade at bay because you couldn't move around. Once apartheid ended, the floodgates opened. You could move around and so could the drugs. Ambrose is someone who also has never held a job. He's now in his early 30s. His teeth, his front teeth are completely knocked out. That is an adaptation that you see in the prison population in South Africa. It's a badge of belonging in the prison gangs. He lives in Manenberg, which is probably one of the most dangerous places I've ever been and far worse than Khayelitsha. In Manenberg, in broad daylight, you are at risk for tremendous assault and violence. And I have been with Ambrose when people have just attacked him out of apparently no motive at all. I mean, attacked him with rocks and sent him running. And so his daily life is one of very high tension, fear of violence from his own people, and no opportunities that he can see at all, although he did work intermittently at low-wage jobs off and on.
Okay, I'm sorry. You were with him, with Ambrose, when he was attacked, seemingly for no reason and out of nowhere. What about you? What about your safety?
When
he ran off, what did you do?
People were worried about my safety. And, you know, I was fortunate to have a research team that included some strong-looking men. and I didn't go into Manenberg by myself. It would have been insanely dangerous to do that. But I would see Ambrose from the distance of a stoop I was sitting on and watched people just pelt him with rocks. And you ask, where did this violence come from? And the answer is daily life in Manenberg is a life of violence. And it got that way because the people who lived there were deported from the center of Cape Town. The adults were having to work in the city, so they left everybody alone during the day. And for generations, that has been a, quote, slumland that has been more or less abandoned by any formal institutions. We don't have places like this in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and you were talking about gangs and gang culture. Talk a little bit more about that. And is the gang culture in South Africa in much in the same way that it is here, that it's a form of security?
It's a form of territorial protection. And in the early years, in, for example, Ambrose's father's generation, it was sort of like the Jets and the West Side Story style gang. You wouldn't really quake in your boots when they came walking. But it evolved into the social structure for the gangs that are really drug-related, and that then began to stretch into the prisons. So it's very much like what we hear for the Crips and the Bloods in California of a social structure that's facilitating the drug trade across the prison community boundary, if you will. So the gangs range all the way from benign to truly violent and frightening. And there are pictures in the book of areas that have been marked by gang insignias. And this tends to be a particular plague in the colored townships like Manenberg.
One person you talked to, Graham, he suggests that violence has become worse since the end of apartheid. I mean, just judging from your answers, you agree with that. And is it just because the drug trade has proliferated?
No,
since the end of apartheid?
One of the things I came to appreciate spending time in South Africa was that the kind of fascism that prevailed under apartheid was very orderly. And so ordinary people, bizarrely as this may sound, felt safer, even though if they were political activists, they were obviously in grave danger. But for ordinary people, that kind of extreme order was some level of protection with respect to just ordinary passage on the street. Once apartheid ended, that iron control disappeared, and all of a sudden you had huge flaring violence in these townships. At the same time, in some of these townships, I would say in Khayelitsha, for example, you have a tremendous amount of bustling activity. You have people who are trying to sell stuff and hustle a life, and they're more active and in many ways more optimistic than in Manenberg, which is depressed and truly violence-ridden. So I don't mean to paint these townships as places of complete, utter, 100% despair. They are very poor, and there are millions of people in them who have very little hope for a decent job. But there are also people with decent lives and some degree of optimism for their children.
I can't believe we have almost run out of time, but I have time for one more question for you, and it's to bring us back to the election. And to see, do you feel this election will begin the normalization of South African politics, or do they still have a long way to go before reaching that point?
It will be normalized in the sense that Mandela is no longer part of the picture, not as a living figure and not as someone who can influence the elections. What I think the country is grappling with now is, where are the leaders going to come from that have anything close to the mantle of legitimacy and moral authority that he had? And they don't see anyone on the scene. The few alternatives that spring up collapse almost as quickly as they spring up. And so I think it's a country that's very much on edge because they don't see the current leadership as credible, but they don't have an alternative to look for either.
How much of a loss in the soul, the psyche of South Africa is Madiba, Nelson Mandela?
Almost impossible to measure. Almost unbelievable. He is a world historical figure, and there may never be another person like him anywhere in the world. And that's a very hard act to follow. It would be a tall order for anyone to try and achieve anything like the prominence he had. But they would settle for people who weren't corrupt, who appeared to share the ambitions he had for a rainbow nation and for greater prosperity for people at the bottom. Anyone who could come along and make a legitimate claim to that kind of aspiration would be welcome.
I've been speaking with sociologist Catherine S. Newman about the inequality that remains in South Africa 20 years after the fall of apartheid and the country's first free elections. She's the co-author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in South Africa. It's published by Beacon Press, and she'll be reading and signing books on Thursday, May 15th at 7 at Book Culture. That's at 536 West 112th Street. For more information, visit our show page, WNYC.org. Catherine, this has been a great discussion. Thanks for joining us
today.
Thank
you.
Thank you.